Chapter 12. Henry Fujima was the last of a dying breed, a fourth-generation Japanese Hawaiian, whose father, his father before him, and his father before him had all been fishermen. For 40 years during good weather, Henry doggedly pursued the elusive tuna in his hand-built sampan. The sampan fleets that Hawaii had known for so many years were gone now. Increasing competition from the international fisheries and from irregular catches had taken their toll of the fleet, until only Henry was left to cast his solitary bamboo pole over the upper skin of the great Pacific. He stood on the rear platform of his solid little craft, his bare feet planted stiffly against the wood, stained through the years from the oil of thousands of dead fish. He cast his line in the early morning marching swells, his mind wandering back to the old days when he fished with his father. He longingly recalled the charcoal smell of the hibachis and the laughter as the sake bottles were passed from sampan to sampan when the fleet met and tied up together for the night. He closed his eyes, seeing the long dead faces, hearing the voices that spoke no more. When he opened them again, they were drawn to a smudge on the horizon. He watched it grow and magnify into a ship, a rusty old tramp that surged through the sea. Henry had never seen a large merchantman cut through the waves so quickly. Judging from the white froth that burst nearly to the hawse holes, the ship's speed was close to 25 knots. Then he froze. The ship was holding her course, and Henry was directly in her track. He tied his shirt to the fishing pole and frantically waved it back and forth. In terror, he watched the bow grow over him like a monster about to swallow a fly. He screamed, but no one appeared over the high bulwarks. The bridge was empty. He stood in helpless bewilderment as the great corroded ship tore into his sampan, shattering the tired little boat into a spray of wooden splinters. Henry struggled underwater, the barnacled plates slicing his arms as they slid past. The propellers thrashed by, and only his desperate struggles kept him from being sucked into their murderous rotating blades. Reaching the surface, he was fighting to catch his breath between the swirling, chopping waves from the ship's wake. At last he managed to keep his head above the surface, slowly treading water and rubbing the salty sting from his eyes, the blood flowing from his torn arms. It was after 10 in the morning when Pitt finally let himself into his apartment. He was tired and his eyes smarted when he closed them. He limped slightly, his leg had been rebandaged, and other than a trace of stiffness, he felt nothing. All he wanted more than anything in the world was to fall into bed and forget the past 24 hours. He had ignored orders to land the crew of the Martha Ann at either Pearl Harbor or on the heliport at Hickam Field. Instead, he had set the helicopter down neatly on the lawn not more than 200 feet from the emergency receiving entrance of Tripler Military Hospital, that great concrete edifice perched on a hill overlooking the south coast of Oahu. He had stood by until Boland and the young wounded seamen were quickly wheeled on their way to the operating tables before he allowed a helpful army doctor to stitch up the gash in his leg. Then he unobtrusively slipped out a side exit, hailed a cab, and peacefully dozed during the ride to Waikiki Beach. He couldn't have been asleep in the familiar comfort of his own bed for more than half an hour when someone began pounding on the door. At first it seemed like a distant echo in the back of his head, and he tried to tune it out. Then he struggled out of bed and weaved across the suite to the door and opened it. There is a strange sort of beauty in a woman caught in the throes of fear, as though a long-hidden animalistic instinct makes her fervently alive. She wore a short muumuu emblazoned with red and yellow flowers that barely covered her hips. Her chestnut eyes gazed up at him, wide, dark, and afraid. Pitt stood there for a moment before he stepped back and motioned her in. Adrian Hunter swept by him into the apartment, turned, and threw herself into Pitt's arms. She was shuddering, and her breath came in choking sobs. Pitt held her. "Adrian, for God's sake!"
"They killed him," she sobbed.
Pitt pushed her back at arm's length and stared into her puffed and wet eyes. "What are you talking about?" The words tumbled out of her.
"I was lying there in bed with a friend. They came through the terrace window, three of them, so quietly we didn't know they were even in the room until it was too late. He tried to fight with them, but they carried funny little guns that made no sound. They shot him. God, they shot him 12 times. His blood was everywhere. It was horrible."
She trembled. Pitt steered her to the couch and held her tightly.
I screamed and ran into the closet and locked the door," she continued. "They laughed. They stood there and laughed. They thought I was trapped in the closet, but it's a two-way closet. It opens up into the guest bedroom. I grabbed a dress off a hook and escaped through the guest room window. I didn't want to go to the police. I was afraid. I tried to call Daddy, but his office said he couldn't be reached. By that time, I was in a panic. I had no place else to go, no one to turn to, so I came here." She brushed at her eyes with her hand. She stood silhouetted against the light, and Pitt could see she wore nothing beneath the muumuu. "It's a nightmare," she whispered. "A dirty, wretched nightmare. Why did they do such a thing? Why?"
"First things first," he said gently. "Get in the bathroom and fix your face. Your eye makeup's halfway down your chin. Then you're going to tell me who it was they killed." She pushed herself away.
"I can't."
"Get wise," he snapped. "There's a dead body decorating your apartment. How long do you think you can keep it a secret?"
I don't know."
"It'll take the Honolulu police all of 20 minutes to put a make on him anyway. Why the martyr act? Is he a local celebrity with a wife and 10 kids or what?"
"Worse. He's a friend of my father's."
Her eyes were pleading. "The name," he demanded.
"Captain Oral Chanana," she murmured slowly. "He's Daddy's fleet officer."
Pitt had enough sense to stay expressionless. It was worse than he thought. He pointed toward the bathroom and simply said, "Go." Obediently, she padded to the bathroom, turned, and gave him a funny, helpless smile, and then closed the door. As soon as he could hear the sound of water splashing in the sink, Pitt reached for the telephone. He had better luck than Adrian. 5 seconds after he told the 101st Fleet's operator his name, Admiral Hunter was exploding on the line. "What in hell's the idea of not reporting to me?" Hunter charged.
"I was spun out, Admiral," Pitt answered. "I would have been no use to you until I cleaned up and grabbed a couple of hours' sleep, which, thanks to your daughter, makes it impossible." When Hunter spoke again, it was in another voice. "My daughter? Adrian, she's with you?" "She's got a dead body in her apartment. She couldn't reach you, so she came here." Hunter paused for all of 2 seconds. Then he came back stronger than ever. "Give me the details. From what little I can get out of her, it seems our friends from the Vortex walked in off the terrace and gunned the guy down. Adrian escaped through a double closet."
"Is she hurt?"
"No." "I suppose the police know about this." "Fortunately, she didn't call them. As far as I know, the victim is still bloodying up her carpet."
"Thank God for that. I'll get our security people over there right away."
Pitt heard Hunter shout muffled commands over the other side of the line. He could easily visualize everyone within shouting distance jumping like frightened rabbits. He came back.
"Did she identify the victim?"
Pitt took a deep breath. "Captain Oral Chanana." Hunter had class. Pitt couldn't take that away from him. The shocked silence ended in a fraction of a moment. "How soon can you and Adrian get out here?"
"At least half an hour. My car is still parked at the Honolulu dock. We'll have to take a cab."
"Better you stay where you are. It seems these killers are everywhere. I'll have a guard detail sent immediately."
"Okay, we'll sit tight."
"One more thing. How long have you known my daughter?"
"Pure coincidence, sir. We both happened to be at the same party a few hours after I brought you the Starbucks capsule."
He made a serious effort to sound extremely casual. "She heard me mention your name, and she introduced herself." Pitt knew what Hunter was thinking, so he second-guessed him. "I suppose during the course of the conversation I must have mentioned that I was staying at the Moana Towers. She must have remembered in her panic and came here."
"I don't know how Adrian screws her life up so," he said. "She's really a very decent girl."
Pitt paused. "How do you tell a father his daughter is a sex maniac who's either drunk or stoned 18 hours out of 24?
"We'll start for Pearl as soon as the guards get here," was all Pitt could think of to say. Then he hung up and poured himself a shot of scotch. It tasted like a drain cleanser. They came 10 minutes later, not to escort them to Admiral Hunter's headquarters at Pearl Harbor, but to abduct Adrian and murder Pitt. His attention was divided between Adrian curled up on the couch, dozing peacefully like a baby, and the front door. Pitt felt the skin on the back of his neck tighten till it seemed it would pull apart. He had no time to grab the phone. They had dropped from the roof on ropes, 5 of them, silently entering the room from the balcony in Pitt's bedroom. Their familiar, compact pistols pointed not at Pitt's heart, but at Adrian's uncaring, unconscious brain. "You move, she dies," said the man in the middle, a giant of a man with blazing golden eyes. Pitt, in those first few seconds of shock, was conscious only of his total absence of emotion, as if his complete lack of anticipation had somehow deprived him of any facility to think. But then came the slow, bitter realization that this massive man standing before him had been manipulating his waking destiny for over a week. It was the man with the deep yellow eyes who had haunted his dreams and nightmares, the man who had discovered the secret of cannoli from the archives of the Bishop Museum so many years ago. The huge man stepped closer. He looked too young for a man who must have been nearing his 70s. The aging process had not wrinkled his skin nor withered his muscles. He was dressed casually like a beach bather with swimming trunks and a hotel towel thrown carelessly over one shoulder, while the other men with him wore street clothes. His face was long and gaunt, and was framed by a heavy layer of unkempt silver hair. The giant walked over and, gazing down from his hypnotic yellow eyes 6 feet 8 inches above the ground, he smiled with the friendliness of a barracuda. "Dirk Pitt of the National Underwater Marine Agency." The voice was quiet and deep, but there was nothing evil or menacing about it. "This is an honor. I have followed your exploits over the years with some interest and occasional amusement." "I'm flattered you found me entertaining." "Spoken like a brave man. I'd have expected nothing less." The giant nodded to his men. They pinned Pitt helplessly to a chair before he could begin to realize what was happening. "My apologies for the inconvenience, Mr. Pitt. A dirty game, unpleasant as dirty games go, but essential. It is unfortunate that I had to draw you into my strategy. I had intended on utilizing your services purely as a messenger. I could not have foreseen your ultimate involvement." "A neatly staged event," Pitt said slowly. "How long did you follow me around, waiting for an opportunity to fox me into discovering the Starbucks message capsule?" "Why me? A 10-year-old boy could have picked up the capsule on the beach and carried it to Admiral Hunter." "Impact, Major. Impact and believability. You have influential friends and relatives in Washington, and your record with Numa is quite respectable. I knew there would be doubts about the accuracy of the message, so I counted on your reputation to give the discovery impact and believability." He smiled faintly and ran his hand through the wavy mass of gray hair. "But it proved to be a most regrettable choice. As it turned out, you were the one who convinced Admiral Hunter that Commander Dupree's message was counterfeit." "A pity," Pitt said sarcastically. He decided to throw out a probe. "Your informant didn't miss much." "Yes, he was quite diligent at times." There was a long moment's silence. Pitt turned and looked at Adrian. She was still serenely curled on the couch. Lucky her, Pitt thought. She's sleeping through the whole ugly scene. He pushed his attention back to the giant. "I don't believe you've given me the courtesy of your name." "It does not matter. My name is of no further consequence to you." "If you're going to kill me, I think it only fair to know who's responsible." The huge man stood there hesitating, then he nodded heavily. "Delphi," he said simply. "That's all?" "Delphi will suffice." "You don't look Greek." Pitt's hands were firmly tied behind the chair now. Two of the men stood guard with their weapons still aimed at Adrian. The other two finished with Pitt and moved back. Except for Delphi, they all looked ordinary. Medium height and weight, tanned skin, dressed in casual slacks and aloha shirts. Their faces were expressionless. They accepted Delphi's unspoken authority mutely and unquestioningly. There was no doubt in Pitt's mind that they would kill on command. "You've built a ruthless and efficient organization. You've concocted one of the great mysteries of the age. Thousands of seamen lie dead from your hands, and for what?" "I'm sorry, Mr. Pitt. This isn't a play where the arch-villain tells all before he does away with the hero. No theatrics, no prolonged climaxes, no suspenseful divulgence of unnecessary secrets. It's a waste of time to explain my motives to anyone with less intellectual understanding than a Lavella or a Robleman." "How do you mean to do it?" "An accident. Since you love the water, you shall die from the water, drowned in your own bathtub." "Won't that appear ridiculous?" "Not really. I intend to make it convincing. The police will simply assume you were shaving with your electric razor while taking a bath. Admittedly, a stupid thing to do. The razor slipped from your hand and into the water. The resulting voltage was sufficient to render you unconscious. Your head slips beneath the water and you drown. The investigators will report it as an accidental death, and why not? Your name will be printed in the obituary columns of the newspapers. And in time, Dirk Pitt will become a distant memory among his relatives. Frankly, I'm astounded I'm worth all the effort. A fitting end for the man who came unnervingly close to destroying an undertaking that has been brilliantly designed and executed for over 30 years. Spare me the ego, Pitt growled. What about Adrian? It might look funny if we both drowned while shaving in the tub. Ease your mind. Miss Hunter is not destined to be harmed. I'm taking her as a hostage. Admiral Hunter will think twice before he continues his quest for the Pacific Vortex. That won't stop Hunter for more than 2 minutes. Duty takes priority to family in his book. You're wasting your time. Let her go. I'm also a man of discipline, said Delphi. I never deviate once I've drafted my plans. My goals are elementary. I simply wish to be free from the destructive designs of the communist countries and the imperialistic impulses of the United States. Between them, they will destroy civilization. I intend to survive. Time, Pitt thought. He had to keep the giant talking. Another few minutes and Hunter's men would be at the door. Talk was his only weapon. You're insane, Pitt said coldly. You've gotten away with mass murder for decades in the name of survival. Spare me the old trite phrases about communism and imperialism. You're nothing but an anachronism, Delphi. Your kind went out of style along with Karl Marx, slicked down hair and buggy whips. You've been buried half a century and don't know it. Delphi's studied calm cracked slightly at the edges. A taut flush touched the wide cheekbones, but he immediately gained control again. Philosophical detachment is for the ignorant, Major. In a few minutes, your irritating harassment will be mine no longer. He nodded. One of the guards went into the bathroom to turn on the water in the bathtub. Pitt tried moving his hands. Although his wrists were wrapped many times, they were loose enough so as not to leave telltale bruises on the skin. Then, suddenly, Pitt thought his senses were deceiving him. The sweet, fragrant smell of plumeria began to envelop him. It was impossible, yet he knew she was there. Summer was in the room. Delphi silently pointed to Adrian, and the man who had tied Pitt pulled a small case from his pocket, inserted a needle into a hypodermic, and then lifted the hem of Adrian's short muumuu, unceremoniously jabbing the needle into one well-rounded buttock's cheek. She stirred slightly, sighed, frowned, and then within seconds went into a sleep bordering on a coma. Quickly, Delphi's assistant placed the hypodermic case back in his pocket and lifted Adrian up in his arms, waiting expectantly for new orders from his master. "I'm afraid this is goodbye," said Delphi. "You're leaving before the main event?" "There is little to see that interests me further. You'll never get her out of the building." "We have a car waiting in the basement garage," Delphi said smugly. He stepped over to the door, opened it a crack, and peered into the hall. As Delphi was halfway through the doorway, Pitt yelled out, "One final question, Delphi." The giant hesitated, turned, and glared at Pitt. "The girl who called herself Summer, who is she?" Delphi grinned evilly. "Summer is my daughter." He waved a salute. "Goodbye, Major." Pitt desperately tried one last parting shot. "Give my regards to the gang on Cannoli." Delphi's eyes hardened. Some unformulated doubt seemed to cloud his mind for a moment. Then it quickly dispersed as he stared at Pitt. "Goodbye," he said, and then he passed into the hallway like a shadow. Pitt had failed to delay Delphi and to prevent Adrian's abduction. He sat there, agonized, as the man in the bathroom came out, nodded, and then returned. The other guard set down his gun in a chair and approached Pitt, his round, ordinary features masking any dark hint of sadistic traits. Pitt saw the blow coming, but was too late to duck. He could only bow his head. The guard's fist connected solidly on the top of Pitt's cranium, smashing him out of the chair to the floor against the balcony curtain. Blackness tightened its hold on his brain, but Pitt shook it off and pushed himself groggily to his feet. He dimly perceived the guard kneeling on the carpet, holding a deformed wrist in one hand, and heard him whining like a wounded animal. "The bastard broke his wrist," Pitt concluded. A grim smile touched Pitt's face as he realized the pain from the growing knot on his head was nothing compared to a fractured bone. Pitt stood without moving. Then a hand from behind the curtains touched his arm. He felt a back-and-forth motion as the cord that bound his arms and wrists was cut. The aroma of plumeria swept over him like a warm and releasing wave. In an instant the bonds were gone, and a small double-edged knife was carefully slipped into the palm of his right hand. He didn't dare turn to her to pull away the curtains that concealed her. Instead, he grasped the knife tightly and wiggled his hands to be sure he could call upon them without any numbness or restricting stiffness. The guard stopped his low wail and began crawling across the carpet toward Pitt. His partner in the bathroom went about his business, not aware of anything above the gush of the bathtub faucet. Then the guard eased the broken limb into his lap, reached toward the chair with his good hand, and grabbed his gun, swinging the muzzle in a short arc and aiming at Pitt's chest, his pain and hate wiping away all thought of obeying Delphi's orders for an accidental death. Sweat drained from every pore on Pitt's body. The guard was too far away to make any kind of a move. The projectile from the gun would ventilate his torso before he could even leap half the distance between them. The guard sat for an agonizingly long time, merely staring at Pitt. Then he began inching closer, pushing one knee in front, then the other, half a foot at a time, narrowing the gap to 5 feet. Still too far. Pitt was going through the tortures of the damned. 3 feet. Pitt needed 3 feet between them before he could strike with any hope of drawing blood first. An arm's length. It would take an arm's length, he told himself as he gauged the required distance. The guard crept closer. He kept the gun pointed at Pitt's chest, letting it wander from time to time to the forehead. Once a smirk crossed his face as he leveled it in the direction of Pitt's genitals. Patience, Pitt told himself over and over. Patience. The two most important words in the English language he repeated in his mind were patience and hope. He just might be able to bring it off. The guard had almost moved into range now. Pitt waited tensely a few seconds longer for insurance. If he rushed the moment, he might not be able to shove the gun far enough away from his body before it discharged. And he had no doubt that the guard's reflexes would squeeze the little firing button at the slightest contact. His only chance of success lay in surprise. He still held his freed hands behind his back, lulling the guard into the security of an easy kill. This had to be it. He let his jaw fall lower and lower and forced his eyes wide in mock terror. Then Pitt lunged. He knocked the gun upward with his left arm, ignoring the hiss of the projectile as it passed a scant inch over his shoulder, while in nearly the same motion he swung his right hand in a short sweeping arc, the sharp blade of the knife slashing the guard's throat to the windpipe. A hideous rasping sound came from the gash in the guard's throat as blood spurted over his chest, over the carpet, over Pitt's arms. The guard's eyes looked on Pitt in glazed shock before they rolled up beneath the lids, and then his body gave a convulsive heave as he slowly collapsed. Pitt sat transfixed for an instant at the sight of the dead guard. Then he retrieved the gun from the floor and stepped softly toward the bathroom. He could hear the whirring of the electric razor as the other guard readied the instrument for Pitt's execution. The tub was full and waiting. Pitt kept his eyes on the bathroom door as he quietly advanced along the wall. Suddenly the doorbell chimes echoed through the apartment. Pitt, jolted by the unexpected sound, jerked up and froze as the guard charged from the bathroom, stopping in mute shock at the ghastly sight of his dead comrade lying on the floor. Then he turned and stared blankly at Pitt. "Drop the gun and freeze," Pitt said sharply. Delphi's executioner stood still and squinted at the small automatic in Pitt's hand. The door chimes sounded again. The man leapt sideways, and as he brought up his gun to fire, Pitt shot his assailant in the heart. The guard remained standing, gaping at Pitt through stunned and vacant eyes. His hands fell limp. The projectile gun dropped softly to the carpet as he slowly sank to his knees before toppling sideways and ending in a fetal position on the floor. Pitt remained immobile, listening to the frantic pounding on the front door, his eyes taking in the debris of death at his feet. The four walls of the room seemed to close in on him. Something was missing. His mind refused to cooperate. The last few minutes had left him confused and numb. Someone else should have been there. Summer. He threw back the curtains that bordered the balcony, finding nothing but the wall behind them. Frantically, he searched the room, calling her name. She did not answer. The balcony, he thought. She must have followed Delphi and his men from the roof. It was empty, but a rope was tied to the railing that led to the terrace of the apartment below. She had escaped the same way as before. Then his eyes caught a small flower lying in one of the lounge chairs. It was a delicate plumeria blossom, its exquisite white bloom flushed yellow on the inside. He held it up, studying it as one might study a rare butterfly. Delphi's daughter, he thought to himself. How was it possible? He was still standing there on the balcony with the flower in one hand and the gun in the other, gazing out over the brilliant blue rippling ocean, when Hunter's security men broke through the door.